Come up, my friend. You're a little late, but it can't be helped. The show has started without us. It's not an especially imaginative program. Middling orchestra and a middling conductor, but, well, one likes the ambiance. Step into my box, won't you? We won't disturb anyone here if we choose to pass the time with one or two lively stories. There we go. Did you happen to notice the street sign as you came in? There's quite the bloody tale behind it. I'll tell it to you sometime. Irish place names can be so evocative. Layer upon layer of history behind them, one on top of the other. Some place names, though, are much less ambiguous. There's nothing enigmatic about Coal Island in County Tyrone, for example. It sits on a seam of coal, and a botched canal project turned the town into somewhat of an island, hence Coal Island. The town was founded where the coal deposits were discovered in the 17th century, a rare commodity in Ireland where coal is pretty thin on the ground or under the ground. And it's in that town that I want to begin our first story for the evening. We've spoken before, I think, about the humdrum horror of life as a 19th century coal miner. Well, the mines around Coal Island had it, so to speak, in spades. Many of those who clambered into the sickening black craw of the earth would never see the sky again. Two notable disasters in 1891 and 1898 created an aura of doom and dread around the Coal Island pits, and in the early years of the 20th century, that aura began to take on a physical form. Well, something like a physical form, anyway. Between 1900 and 1906, there were a spate of ghost sightings around the Coal Island pits. Something, it seemed, wanted to remind the locals and the miners that death, a blind and lonely death, was lurking at the bottom of the shaft, as if they could have forgotten that. But it was the year of 1906 that truly struck fear into the calloused hearts of the men who faced death for a living. Deep in the winter of 1906, in the stillborn days of early December, a new pit opened at a place called Red Row, just outside the town of Coal Island. Now, coal miners were a hardy breed. They had to be. Their lives were tough, their days were long, and numbered none too high. They didn't need to conjure up phantom threats or outlandish fears of ghastly things lurking in the dark. The threats they faced every day were all too real. And yet, in those bleak December days of 1906, there was, it seems and it said, a terror lurking above ground to match any in the pit. Just off the country road that ran towards the new pit stood an old chestnut tree. In the penal times, when the open practice of the Catholic faith was illegal, it was known as a mass tree, a spot where fugitive priests and furtive worshippers would hold forbidden clandestine masses. Beneath its lumbering branches, stripped bare by the northern winter, on this spot sacred to their persecuted forefathers, that's where they first saw her. A woman, dressed in purest white, picked out in the moonlight against the black countryside, making her way slowly across the country road. She was most often seen at midnight, but sightings were reported as late or as early as 4 o'clock of a December morning, which must have been a uniquely terrifying experience in the dead, dark midwinter hours. Young mine worker James Hughes was one of the first to see the figure, late in November, in fact, at 1:30 in the morning, circling the shed about 25 yards from the pit. Whether Hughes kept that initial encounter to himself, we don't know. But we do know that the following night, Hughes and his colleagues were sitting in the cabin when the figure showed its form again. "It was draped in white," said Joe McMahon, "and it had a white cover on its head. You could not see the arms and legs on it, but it was distinctively the form of a human being." Such was the panic caused by this nocturnal visitor that local clergymen were called in to salve the men's nerves, no doubt at the initiative of the mine owners, who probably cared as little for the miners' spiritual peace of mind as for their physical safety, but were mindful of any impediment to their profits, supernatural or otherwise. But despite the appeals, despite the blessings and the incantations, the sightings continued. And even if the religious rites failed to shift her, the lady, if such she was, not everyone agreed the form was female, or even that it was human, but it did seem to fear God when confronted face to face with the Almighty or with appeals to the Almighty. A typical encounter with the white figure was described along the following lines. "She would appear on the country road, white as a snowdrop, making her way, slowly but determinedly, towards the pit. When a miner caught sight of her, as many claimed to, they did what any terrified Christian, Protestant or Catholic, would do in those days. They instantly began to pray for protection." Whether the white lady could see or hear their terrified mumblings, or whether she had some other sense that apprehended this appeal to God, the lady would suddenly, sharply twist her head towards the praying miner, and then, with an instant jolt, disappear down into the earth. Well, what was a miner to make of that? If this creature could be banished by prayer, banished back below ground, where else could she have come from but from the mine or from hell itself? For men who had to shake off their encounter with the white lady and then spend 8 to 12 hours flat on their stomachs, with barely room to swing a pick, in total seething blackness, it must have made for some long and petrifying shifts. Now, there are always those who will doggedly pursue a rational cause for any manifestation of the supernatural, and it must be said that in this case, that explanation was quite persuasive. As panic spread, and as the tale of the white lady began to be told around the hearths and the pubs of Coal Island and the adjoining district, a number of locals volunteered to spend a night at the mine, to keep vigil with the miners for the lady's inevitable appearance. Just at the appointed time, as the locals steeled their nerve for a visit from beyond, something appeared on the country road, edging towards the mine in the moonlight, whitish grey and growing more distinct with every second. They watched and waited and waited and watched, mouths drying up, hearts skipping beats, until at last the shape was close enough for them to distinguish its full figure from head to toe. It was, indisputably, a pale grey donkey. They recognized the donkey. In fact, it belonged to a local man named John Corr, and it had evidently developed the habit of taking a midnight stroll by the newly sunken pits. Well, that was the explanation that satisfied the frightened people of Coal Island, and thereafter, the story of the White Lady died a natural death. It must be said that the donkey thesis did accord with some descriptions of a white figure with pointy ears and a tail 2 feet long, although others insist that the figure took on different forms at different times, shifting between them before the witness's eyes. For my part, I have never known a donkey to vanish at the point of a prayer, but perhaps it's best to let sleeping donkeys lie and close the book here on this tale of the donkey's tail. Not the most inspired program, is it? But I suppose one has to cater for all tastes. You see that gentleman in the dress circle? The one with the deep scar on his neck? Would you like to know where he got it? It's not a pretty story. Another time, perhaps. Now, I want you to think of a place in Ireland, and we'll see if we can dredge up a dread tale from its history. Oh, you were thinking of Dublin. Not especially original, but why not? Why not indeed? Now, how about this story from the year of 1926 and the village of Talla, way down in the south of County Dublin? You'll note I said village. The old country village that was Talla has long since been subsumed by a heaving populous suburb, almost a city apart from Dublin itself today. But back in the day, it was indeed a small country village on the rural fringe of the county, and long before that it was the location of an ancient monastery. Today's bustling suburb sits, quite literally, on top of the skeletons of the past. Indeed, the name Talla, Taulach in Irish, probably means something like plague pit. But let's not retreat quite that far back. Let's go back a century or so to 1926, when Talla was still a village in South County Dublin, part of the newly, or partly independent, Irish Free State, and troubled by strange apparitions on its lonely country roads. This is an unusual story. It dates from a period just after the tumult of the wars that had racked Ireland in the early 20th century, from the First World War to the Civil War. And the witnesses in this case are serious, sober people, not given to wild flights of fancy. Now, even by the contemporary standards of post-Troubles rural Ireland, 1920s Talla was a deathly quiet place. There was little in the way of entertainment, although the coming of the tram line in the late 1880s took the edge off the cabin fever, opening up Dublin and Blessington while it lasted, which it didn't for very long. But other than the occasional whistle and chug of the passing tram, and the odd stray moo from the grazing cattle, a typical night in Talla brought nothing but damp grey silence at the foot of the mountains. So imagine how disturbed a certain well-to-do local farmer must have been when he had the following experience, going to milk the cows in the wee small hours one night in the winter of 1925. As he put it in his own words, "I was going out with Carlo, a well-bred collie, when I saw what I thought was a woman coming out of some cottages by the side of the road and walking towards me. She seemed to be floating along the ground rather than walking. She wore the usual attire of a country woman, and as far as I could make out in the moonlight, it seemed to be a brown coat and costume. Carlo the collie, whom the farmer described as a very plucky dog, instantly began trembling and ran away in panic. The farmer stood gingerly by the side to let the figure pass before continuing on his way to milk the cows. It was another hour and a half before Carlo reappeared, still trembling violently. The figure was seen by other locals walking that lonely road from Talla to Jobstown at night, and while some laughed off the notion of a ghostly presence, they also admitted that they wouldn't walk that road alone at night, just in case, you understand. One interesting aspect of this case was the credence given to it by the Civic Guard, the new police force of the new state. One local guard, newly assigned to the district, actually spoke to the spectre and got a reply. Passing the figure on the road, deep in the night, he offered a civil good night. It responded at once. "Don't stop me," the voice snapped. "I'm hurrying to the chapel." Now, no one could have had any legitimate business at the chapel at that hour of night, so the guard was about to reply when suddenly, the woman simply disappeared. Right in front of his eyes. Unnerved, but not being paid to ponder the existence of the supernatural, the guard did his best to put the incident to the back of his mind. And when next he encountered the old lady of the road, he very deliberately, and perhaps very wisely, ignored her altogether. Some nights later, the same guard headed out on patrol with a colleague back down that lonely Talla Jobstown road at the ungodly hour of 2 a.m. Now, this was still a somewhat troubled time in Irish history, and indeed, the Talla police barracks would be raided by armed Republicans later that same year. But the guards would have expected little to raise the pulse on their late stroll down that country road. Just 100 yards from the barracks, however, the guard once again caught sight of the old woman, gliding, not walking, but gliding towards him. She came to a halt by the side of the road, and raising her hand, began to beckon the guard towards her. The second guard noticed that the new recruit was trembling and agitated beside him. But why, he could not guess. Because despite his colleague's frantic gesticulations, the second guard, a hard-bitten IRA veteran of the troubled times, could see absolutely nothing. Note the word "see" because while the senior guard brushed off the incident when quizzed by a reporter from the Irish Independent, he did admit that though he saw nothing on the night, he did feel something brush past. "You know the way you realize something has passed close to you at night," he said. "It wasn't an animal. I don't know what it was." When asked if he thought the presence was an ordinary human being, he responded, "No." The guard also remarked that he had often seen the old lady so keenly described by his colleague walking the roads at night, but he knew nothing of the ghost legend and thought he was encountering a normal, everyday citizen, albeit one that kept very strange hours. The Irish Independent reporter, perhaps hoping for a classical ghost story with all the trimmings, was disappointed to find some elements lacking. As he put it, the scene is neither eerie nor desolate. It is a commonplace, straight, level country road, with no giant trees to cast sinister shadows or make weird sounds when the wind moans through their branches. Still, the reports were too much for some people. It seems locals were not so much spooked by the apparition itself as by the reputation the story might earn them. They didn't want to be seen as superstitious bumpkins afraid of their own shadows. So when the newspapers came back a few days later, they met with a very different reception. No sightings of the ghost, previously so reliable, have been reported since its exposé in the Irish Independent. Indeed, one Russian lady who had tramped the byroads of Tala until the wee small hours in the hope of connecting with the spectre ultimately gave it up as a bad job. Even the local civic guard had been won over to scepticism, perhaps after a flea in their ears from their commanders, worried that they might bring the new force into disrepute, although that ship had already sailed by 1923. In fact, the guards curtly told the reporter that they were now of the view that the figure seen on the road was simply an elderly local lady and that no further investigation was required. Perhaps. In any case, if she wasn't already dead then she most certainly is now, one way or the other. Did her presence linger as her village became a town? Was she watching as they laid tarmac over that lonely country road? As the housing estates sprang up around her domain? Forgotten for a century, does she perhaps watch still? And now that you know of her, might she reach out again across the decades, looking for a kindred spirit to walk the lonely night by her side? Are you shivering? It's quite warm in here. I knew a cellist who used to say that one couldn't play Bach at less than 25 degrees because it lent a bitter, brittle tone to the notes. Some people are altogether too precious about these things, I think. Well, speaking of spooks that fell foul of the law, did you ever hear tell of the fraudulent Phantom of Fermoy? Back in the 1970s, a chap who wrote into the Cork Evening Echo passed on this story of an encounter that, according to him, had happened locally many years earlier. To tell it as it's told, a wealthy man died in or around Fermoy, leaving a distraught widow behind. One night, around midnight, there was a loud knock on the widow's door. She opened the door and found herself face to face with an imposing figure dressed in white robes. The figure spoke in a booming voice. It told her that her husband had not gone straight to heaven, but was suffering the pains of purgatory. The figure itself had emerged from purgatory, sent on a mission to redeem the rich man's sins in life. For this purpose, it asked that the widow withdraw £100 from her bank and present it to the trapped soul on her doorstep, who would return for it the following night. This, she was assured, would hasten her husband's passage to heaven. And this she did, handing over a crisp bundle of notes, total value £100, princely sum at the time, to the phantom in the white flowing robes the following night, whereupon the phantom demanded 100 more. Once again, the widow went to her bank, withdrew the money, and presented it to her punctual midnight visitor. But this, alas, was not enough to purge her late husband's misdeeds on earth. and so she went, as requested, back to her bank once more, taking out another £100 from her rapidly dwindling reserves. This might have continued indefinitely had it not been for the suspicions of the bank manager, who discreetly took the woman aside and asked her to explain this strange pattern of withdrawals. The woman, relieved to unburden herself of her awful secret, told the bank manager everything. The ominous knock on the door, her visitor from the depths of purgatory, her husband's unpurged sins, the lot. The following night, the figure appeared once again at the widow's door. But this time, his knock was answered by several burly officers of the Royal Irish Constabulary. The fraudster was swiftly exposed and may well have longed for the comforts of purgatory as he spent 6 months in the dingy recesses of Cork Jail. Now, before this all wraps for the evening, why don't we pay a visit to one of the most haunted places in Ireland? A place that inspired the likes of Jonathan Swift in some of his furthermost flights of the fantastical. It's a place you've probably never heard of, located as it is in the wilds of County Cavan. It's the village of Quilca, between Virginia and Mulla, in the north of the county. Dark tales had been told of Quilca for generations, typically centering on the mountain-fed waters of Quilca Lake, or on Quilca House itself, a house with quite the literary heritage. It had been in the interconnected Brinsley, Sheridan and Leffenu families, and Jonathan Swift himself is said to have completed the writing of Gulliver's Travels there. Some of the tales of the lake are general, familiar. There's another tale of a phantom football match, a tale as you might hear in many parts of the country, and we've spoken about before, played by moonlight at unearthly hours of the night. In this telling, the Quilca telling, a farmer was making his way home from the fair in Virginia when he passed through Quilca late at night and came across a group of men playing football in a field. The game was fast, furious, and played in total silence. As the farmer sat on the ditch, enjoying the novelty of this silent moonlit game being played out before him, he began to pick out familiar faces among the players. It dawned on him that he knew them all, that all the players were known to him, and that they all had something else in common, because every last one of them had died. The game before him was being played by two teams of dead men. He scrambled back up the ditch, hurried home, and fainted as soon as he shut the door. An evocative variation on a familiar tale, the first one I've encountered in which the players are said to be ghosts rather than fairy beings or supernatural visitors of another kind. The tales of Quilca Lake are similarly eerie, of coffins topped with lighted candles floating on the lake as harbingers of death, of ghostly vessels afloat at midnight, crewed by ghostly musicians whose weird music floated across the lake in the wee small hours. But the story I want to close with tonight is of somewhat more recent vintage. Well, it belongs to the age of mass media, tram cars and gaslight, at least. It was all faithfully reported across multiple weeks in early 1904, in the pages of the Anglo-Celt newspaper. And unusually, this is not a tale of things seen, but of things unseen and merely heard. This is the story of the unearthly voice of Cuilca. It seems that from late December 1903 into early 1904, the dark, dreary nights had been pierced by a bellowing, shrieking, and disembodied voice. Locals had heard it for miles around. Some associated it with the late Dean Swift himself, a claim that the demon which was said to have possessed Swift in his latter years was now searching for a new victim. This was something of a leap, given that Swift had died a century and a half earlier, and that his unorthodox behaviour in his last years was probably due to stroke and dementia rather than demonic possession. Whatever their source, the shrieks and the screams continued and continued to be heard. The witness accounts piled up. When a reporter from the Anglo-Celt made his first visit, he found countless locals who had heard the phenomenon, but none who had seen any physical manifestation. All agreed, however, that whatever was making the appalling sound could not have been of this world. Many of the perhaps dozens of accounts he collected described it like this. The noise would start as a low, mournful moan, sudden, out of nowhere, tied to no figure or creature that could be seen. It would become louder and louder and louder until the shrieking became unbearable, akin, some said, to the grunts of 100 infuriated pigs. Now, wherever there's a nameless menace lurking in the shadows, you'll find a young man foolhardy enough to go out in search of it. And in this case, the young man in question sallied forth to Cuilca Lake, armed with a shotgun and the company of two friends, which was all the support he could muster from the youth of the town. The ghost hunting party arrived on the shores of Cuilca Lake and settled in to stalk their supernatural prey at around 10 p.m. It was a cold, lonely vigil as the hours ticked by. 11 o'clock, midnight, 1 o'clock, into the wee small hours with no blood-curdling shriek to be heard anywhere. Just the gentle swish of the lake water and the winter winds rushing through the grass. At 3 o'clock, fingers frozen and eyelids drooping, the ghost hunters rose, vindicated. They had suspected all along that the screeches and screams were the work of a practical joker, and what joker would take his joke far enough to risk a volley of buckshot? Satisfied that they had solved the mystery, the party set off for their homes, which two of them reached unmolested. The third, the man with the shotgun, the man who had been the brave adventurer who challenged the voice to show itself, well, he made it back to his yard. But before he could turn the handle of his door, a wild, terrifying shriek arose above him. Above him, that is, unconnected to any physical form, howling and yelping and screaming from the black sky, and causing him to throw his shoulder against the door, scramble inside and slam it shut. From that moment on, we're told, he kept his curiosity strictly to himself. He was far from the only one panicked by this demonic voice from nowhere. Two pig farmers who knew nothing of the voice or its legend stopped for a chat and a rest near Cuilca on their way to the fair at Oldcastle. Their pigs never made it to market that day, because from nowhere, a sound described as a wild shriek mingled with laughter arose above them, causing the men to start and their pigs and horse to stampede wildly in all directions. Both men were hurt in the kerfuffle, and although they managed to round up their livestock, they scurried swiftly home without pressing on further, with tails between their legs, pigs and human alike. A man with the fine old cabin name of Gillick spoke to the Anglo-Celt when their correspondent returned the following week to find the district still terrorized and panic-stricken. Mr. Gillick said the cattle, apparently as disturbed by these events as the local people, hadn't stopped lowing in the fields after dark for weeks. The omnipresent voice, which could travel across country at infinite speed and make itself heard at will, had even gained a sinister nickname. Locals now called it simply the King. Now it's at this point that the story appears to have melded somewhat with existing shards of local folklore, with tales of the fairy folk and their wraiths, their sacred earthen fortresses, such as might have been heard in any village in Ireland at that time, and still to this day. They began to be mingled with the story of the king, and it's difficult to disentangle them. It was said that a very short woman in a red coat had visited the house of a farmer who levelled a wrath, and warned him that the weird happenings would not stop until he rebuilt the fairy fort and buried the implements that had destroyed it 10 feet down in the centre of the rath. Again, belief in the good people, the fairy folk, was so widespread that this was as good an explanation as many locals felt they had a right to expect. But still, the voice continued to cackle and chuckle and boom, and the sightings, or the soundings, continued to roll in. A Mr. Fox was visiting the home of a Mr. Mortimer, farmers both, when both men heard the dread sound at the same time, putting to bed any notion that it was a trick of either one of their minds. Indeed, Mr. Fox told the man from the Anglo-Celt that he had heard the king no fewer than 20 times. He described it as a throaty sound, as loud as the roar of an infuriated lion. Mr. Fox had been speaking to an officer of the Royal Irish Constabulary, holidaying in the area, who was greatly amused by the local hysteria, when mid-conversation, the shrieking started up once again. The officer proceeded into the house, said Mr. Fox, in double-quick time. He also noted that the terrible roaring had been heard at the same time in 3 separate locations. James Tormey, a local celebrity and All-Ireland champion dancer, had heard the sound just once and said he hoped never to hear it again. He described it as a loud hysterical yell, filling the air and enough to freeze the blood in one's veins. Tormey's experience had happened 2 months earlier, but one witness suggested that the thing, whatever it was, had deeper roots, much deeper roots, in fact. This man, a local district councillor, reported matter-of-factly that there had been an evil spirit in Quilca Lake 40 years earlier, in his childhood, and that it had clearly now returned. As the weeks wore on, more local luminaries spoke out. A Mr. Farrelly, a prominent local member of the United Irish League, agitators for land reform, not a man to scare easily, encountered the king on a midnight walk. It began softly, as it always did, like the neighing of a horse in the distance, growing louder, working itself up to a bellow, and then a roar so loud it was deafening, for receding in the opposite direction as Farrelly ran for home in terror of his life. Well, at this point, two explanations for the origin of this terror were proffered. The one chilling, the other prosaic. Which would you like to hear first? Yes, let's get the rational one out of the way first. In late February, a mechanic wrote to the Anglo-Celt with his explanation for what was going on. It seems he himself had encountered the voice some years earlier and had found out, how he doesn't say, exactly what was producing it. It seems the trick was to cut a hole in the bottom of a large tin can, to run a cord covered with resin through the hole, and bellow into it while pulling the cord back and forth. This, he said, could, would, and did produce a horrifying, unearthly sound. To detect the source of the trick, for that's what he said it was, all one had to do was get one's own tin can, cut a hole in it, pull a rope through, and start pointing it around until the sound resonated in the can. This would lead you directly to the miscreant. Well, how many tin cans were sacrificed in such attempts, we don't know, but it all sounds rather complex and far-fetched to me. Far better, at least far more interesting, the explanation offered by local residents to the man from the Anglo-Celt, which takes us back to 1879, and a man from Ardlow named Farrell, who had emigrated to Scotland with his family as a child. But dreams of his homeland never left him, and one dream in particular saw him pack up a bag and cross the Irish Sea to County Cavan. You see, Farrell had dreamt of treasure, of an actual hidden treasure, and the dream had told him that this treasure was buried under a mound on the shores of Quilca Lake. And so Farrell braved the stormy seas, arrived back in Cavan, stayed with a man named Patrick Morgan, and one evening, Farrell, Morgan, and another helper hoisted their spades on their back and set off for Quilca. They found the spot Farrell had seen in his dream and set to work, digging and sifting and toiling, greedy for the treasure clasped within the cavern soil. After an hour's hard work, something caught their attention. Not within the earth, but out on the lake. The lake itself, in fact, had become wildly agitated, the waters churning and bubbling as though they were boiling up. And as the men looked on bewildered, a wild howl pierced the air. Shrieks arose from the dark waters, and blinding lights flashed all around until a sound like horses' hooves clattered from the waters, and the men dropped their spades, forgot about their treasure, and ran for home and safety. Well, whatever they unleashed that evening in 1879 had never returned to the lake. That said, it did disappear from the local papers, squeezed out by a sensational murder trial related to a man called Joseph Fee, who had killed an egg dealer named John Flanagan for his money. Two juries failed to reach a verdict before a third trial in Belfast saw Fee hanged shortly before Christmas. Interestingly enough, this case also produced a ghost story of its own. The street on which Flanagan was killed was shrouded in darkness for a time, because the lamplighters refused to venture there after his ghost was seen outside the slaughterhouse in which he was murdered. As for the king, the phantom voice of Quilca, well, it was definitely still being heard as late as 1953. Is it still there now? Well, I couldn't possibly say. But Farrell's treasure lies unclaimed by the shores of Quilca Lake. awaiting someone brave enough to take on the challenge. You know, I think the last note has rung out here. We seem to be the last ones to leave. I'll go on ahead and make sure the doors aren't locked. If they are, we can always break a window. You wait there, and well, keep an ear out for uncanny noises.